You know how it goes in the show. When we've had a week where we cover some darker themes in a more serious book, it's nice to follow things up with something lighter. Of course, it doesn't always happen that way. We tend to cover a lot of darker material on this show, but this week, thankfully, is an exception. We're talking about a beloved children's classic that somehow I had never read before this last couple of weeks, but I'm so happy that I finally did. So sit back and enjoy my discussion with Natalka Burian as we talk about From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. And of course, no spoilers. Welcome to your favorite book. Right. So, Natalka, thank you for joining me today. I know this is a busy, hectic time of year for you with a book coming out. So thanks for taking a little bit of time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited about this conversation.
Yeah, I know. We were talking about how you picked a book, and we're going to get into it a little bit later, but you picked a book that had been on my radar for so long, but I had never actually picked up and read. And I always love those moments. I'm always thankful to get to something that had been on the back of my list, so to speak. And before we get to all of that, could you tell everybody, you know, a little bit about yourself and about your work?
Of course. So my name is Natalka. I am an author. My latest book, The Night Shift, is coming out on July 12th, so very soon. Mm-hmm. And this book is kind of magical realism, mystery. I've written a few other books in different genres, including a cocktail book, because in my day job, I am a bar owner. So, and the protagonist of this book is a bartender. So I've really been able to cross-reference all areas of my life for this particular project.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because your book is really hard to categorize in terms of genre, but I like the magical realism, the speculative elements, and kind of crosses genre in a few ways. But let's start with that aspect of it. So first of all, like I told you before we started recording, I really enjoyed your book. I just thought, you know, from a premise on its own, I used to live in New York, and your book really brought back some of those New York memories. It just felt very real to me, down to, you know, getting cheap pizza late at night, navigating.
Iconic yes. New York life.
You have to do it. You have to do it. And then like navigating public transport and what have you, and all of those elements that really make you New York unique. But I want to touch on an element of life that I myself have never experienced, and maybe some of my listeners haven't. And that's, you know, working sort of the opposite of that 9-to-5 job, you know, working in the service industry, the food service industry, where your shifts are a little more erratic and you kind of operate on a different schedule. And I feel like nowadays that kind of work has taken on a whole new meaning with the pandemic and
growing
income inequality. Yes. And, you know, it's really become more and more difficult to be in the service industry. And
yes.
So I guess my question is, you know, what do you think some of us who are more 9-to-5, so to speak, what do you think we're not understanding about those who are working in these industries, and what do you think we need to understand?
Oh man, that is maybe the best question I've been asked. Honestly, that is such a good question. And thank you for this question, because I think a lot of people sort of, you know, and I think that's why it works so well in fiction to use a lot of characters in this line of work, because so many of these jobs are very like invisible jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, like these people are background characters, and so like in every TV show, every movie, every book. And it's really interesting to focus on one of these as a protagonist. In my experience working in hospitality, I have always been astonished by how creative all of my colleagues have been. I mean, mm-hmm. everyone, whether they're, you know, working these jobs because they're actors trying to go on auditions, or because they're musicians, like, you know, trying to go on tour, and it's a flexible, you know, it allows flexible scheduling, and it allows time for to pursue creative work. But I will say that across the board, every single person I've ever worked with has been creative in some way, has had a mm-hmm. creative pursuit outside of the industry. And I think that the more that people sort of understand how much creative care goes into the work of caring for someone in a communal space like this, I think it's not just someone bringing you your tray of food. It's literally someone creating an immersive storytelling experience for you every night on every shift I've ever worked. That has been the the goal of myself and all my colleagues. It's to create this evening, this perfect evening for people who need different things, who want, who expect different things from the night. And then also, and with the pandemic too, I mean, it's been a challenge, certainly, to create a space that's welcoming to everyone, because everyone's coming from such a different place of, you know, some people are just out, have left their apartments and never want to go back in their apartments. And mm-hmm. some people, it was really hard for them to come out. So it's even harder. You have to get even more creative to make everyone feel comfortable in the same space. And I would say that, like, I don't think anyone could do it the way that my colleagues in the service industry do it. And I know, you know, of course, nobody's a doctor. No one's like, you know, we don't work, you know, no one's working in a hospital. But I do feel like there is an element of risk and sacrifice that goes into this work as well. Now this has assumed a new level of responsibility to the community.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And, you know, you say, you know, it's not equivalent to healthcare work, but there's a reason we have essential workers being such a broad category, and, you know, food service, retail, a lot of these shift jobs kind of fall into that category. And you also see, you mentioned the creativity in not only in the workplace, but outside the workplace. And, you know, in the throes of the pandemic, we were seeing all of those creative outlets being sort of cut away, music, theater, acting, things like that. Those were definitely suffering. And then restaurants and bars were also suffering as well. And now we're noticing, you know, as cities get more expensive, people can't afford to live in the cities where they work. And we're starting to see that, like, service work is the backbone of our economy, and things are just kind of falling apart. I didn't mean for this to be so morose.
No, but listen, we're telling the truth here today. We've got to, it's our obligation. No, absolutely. I think that's so true. And I think, you know, I think this extends beyond the purview of any individual citizen. I think there has to be real government assistance for a lot of small businesses and a lot of people who work in these industries that just doesn't exist right now. And I think that just structurally, I mean, to salvage these vital communities, you know, we're still recovering very much.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, things are not over, and the aftermath of the most severe elements of it are certainly not over. We're dealing with a lot of that fallout. And sort of transitioning a little bit to the book itself. So you mentioned that the book is a little bit different than what you've written before. You've written, you know, as you mentioned, a cocktail book, and this one's more of a magical realism speculative kind of book. And so I'm curious about the writing approach for these very disparate kind of genres, you know, the differences for you between writing fiction and nonfiction, as well as weaving in some of these more magical elements. What was that like for you?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I find it writing to be so fun. And when you said, you know, all these businesses kind of came to a standstill, this is what I did. You know, like my business closed, and I found myself with a lot more time on my hands. So I was able to write and sort of delve into a new ground. And also it was a way to escape. You know, I wrote this book when I was in the same apartment as my husband and my two children. And it was like literally the only time to be alone, and to sort of like, I literally folded myself into the computer is how it felt sometimes.
Yeah. That makes sense. You know, I've heard that a lot interviewing people for the show, especially recently. A lot of these books are coming out, you know, having been written during the throes of the pandemic. And, you know, sometimes you do have that extra time, but you also have an increasing number of distractions since everyone's at home with you.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, so your book, you know, it doesn't fit neatly into a genre like fantasy or sci-fi. It doesn't, but there are world building elements. There are rules to the system that you've developed. And tell me about coming up with those rules. Were the rules hard for you to find? You know, how did that all work for you?
That's such a good question too. It's so funny. A lot of them erupted organically, just because I was thinking about how they could add the most pressure and attention to my character's story, because they're accessible when she's working. So it's really hard for her to access them just, you know, out of curiosity or to pursue the mystery at the heart of the story. So it was easy to impose that particular rule because it was an added stressor to her. But overall, yeah, I think it was also just to keep me on track, and sort of, you need to sort of have the guardrails there, especially with time travel narratives. I am so great. I've never written anything like this. And I was so grateful for every copywriter, my editor, every extra pair of eyes on this manuscript, because there were so many things that I'm like, it's Wednesday actually. And, you know, oh, no, but that's, you know, Thanksgiving is always on Thursday. And I had no you know, I just, it just, you really get lost really quickly. So having the rules were actually very helpful to me as the writer, not just to, you know, not just part of the story.
Yeah, I often find that, you know, especially when you delve into these magical elements, not only do you need the rules to keep yourself on track, but it can also be very freeing when you have a set of structures, you know, working within those allows for, you know, a whole new type of creativity to come through when you have, yes, these sort of restraints upon you. Your book, you know, if everyone's kind of trying to get a feel for the kind of time travel and, you know, space travel that we're talking about here, if anyone's read a book called Before the Coffee Gets Cold, that's a book that your book reminded me a lot of, you know,
nice.
Just the elements Thank of you. Constraint with time travel, you know, following these rules. Your book takes things in obviously a very different direction, but that's a book that I feel like appealed to my need to have ground rules and grounding when I read, yes, something a little more fantastical, but then allowing for that greater creativity.
Yes, absolutely.
And so, I mean, we could go at length about your book in particular. I honestly feel like this is a book people need to check out. I really enjoyed your book. I thought it was a fast-paced read. It had, you know, this wonderful balance of internal and external conflict. I just loved being immersed in like the New York night scene again.
Oh, thank you so much. That means so much to hear. Thank you. I really appreciate
that. Absolutely. And there's just a tremendous amount of depth, and I don't want anyone to miss out on this book. I think a lot of my listeners will definitely enjoy it, but I don't want to spoil any more than that. And so let's transition a little bit over to the book you chose for this episode, which, like I mentioned, it's a book I've been on my radar for a while. It is From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, which if you're not me, I'm guessing a lot of you listeners have probably read this book before. It's been for ages. It's a book a lot of people picked up as children.
Yes.
And I find it really funny. The first place I ever heard of this book is it's briefly mentioned on The Office once.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's I've seen The Office like 5,000 times, so that's why I remember it. But there's a, for all my Office nerds, there's a episode called Take Your Daughter to Work Day, and so all the kids are coming into the office, and one of the kids is reading this book, and Jim is like, oh, I love that book. And it's like, would you rather spend the night at the Met or the aquarium? And he's like making conversation with this kid. And that's the first place I had heard of this book. But then I realized I had read one of E.L. Konigsberg's other books in school, and that was The View from Saturday. And I was like, oh, I didn't know these were by the same writer. There's all these little connections. So I was just so happy to get to this one. But before we get to the book in particular, Natalka, can you tell us about, you know, where you were in your life when you first read this and, you know, what kind of impression it had on you?
Absolutely. So I read this book as a child. I read it probably, I believe it was the third grade when I read this. And I grew up on a farm. I should start this with, I grew up in the middle of nowhere on a farm, like no neighbors, like very, and I, as you can tell from my name, I was definitely not like the usual, I was not like, I definitely stood out in my, in my third grade class. So I was a kind of an isolated kid in every way, like emotionally, physically isolated on this farm with my family. Mm-hmm. And I have always, like, it always felt wrong to me. Like, that always felt so painful. And I would say reading this book kind of opened my eyes to the possibility of life in a city, or like the enchantment of like what life among other people would be. And there are so many great scenes in this book where the kids are just like immersed in other people, you know, like they're in this flood of visitors to the Met. And to me, that was like more magical than actual magic.
I love that, because, you know, that's an element of this that you can take for granted. It's just the beautiful immersion of being stuck in a city like this. And for those of you who are like me, hadn't read this book before, so for a little brief summary. So our main character is Claudia Kincaid. She's 12 years old. She has this yearning to be different. And then along with her brother, Jamie, she meticulously plans a runaway to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And then the two of them become involved in a mystery surrounding one of the statues, which may or may not have been created by Michelangelo, and they get sort of immersed into that. And that's a good point. Like, I was thinking at first, you know, there may or may not be connections between your book and this book, but no, they both capture that magic of city life so well.
Oh man, thank you for that. That is a huge compliment, because I was so enchanted by, it was probably my first introduction to New York City. as a concept. And I was so enchanted. And it never, obviously, like, I moved to New York when I turned 18 and I've never left. I've been here for 22 years. Mm. And I think it really just, like, that book hooked me. Like, that was the book that sort of introduced me to all of the possibility that, and again, like, secrets, like, the city is so big and so full of these, like, secret, like, can you imagine, like, it's totally plausible two little kids to be hiding out in the Met, you know? I mean, it's just absolutely. So, it's so fascinating.
And the things that, you know, seem magical when you don't grow up in a city setting. I mean, I didn't grow up on a farm, but I grew up very much in the, you know, suburbs. Just the idea of being able to walk from place to place.
Yes. Oh, my. Yes.
I'm like, I live in a suburb now. I lived in New York for about 2 years. And I live in a place now where it's like, you can walk for miles and reach nothing. Like, yes. I can't imagine, you know, being a kid and reading this, and I'm like, what? You can just walk from place to place and kids kind of go. It's just unreal. Yeah. And of course, you know, to kind of put this book in setting, this book was written in the late 60s, I believe. And so it's very much sort of immersed in that time. But a lot of it still feels like the New York I walked around in a few years ago. You know,
I totally agree.
It's got that timelessness for sure. And I think, you know, this book is so charming. I have to preface, I absolutely loved this. I actually found an audiobook of this, and
The audiobook,
it's so short. It's just a great listen while you're doing other things. And I love children's books where you have this sort of outside narrator who we learn is Mrs. Bazley Frankweiler herself, you know, narrating the story of the Kincaid children. And the way she talks about them and treats their story, I just love it when children's perspectives and interests are given sort of their due diligence and are given credit, and they're not being talked down to or talked down about. Totally. I love children's books that do that.
I totally agree. And I think that adds to sort of the magical quality of this book to a reader, to a young reader who that experience is really profound, to sort of see that experience, because so often, you know, kids are kind of just like an afterthought.
Yes, for sure. And then Claudia and Jamie too, they're like a great team. I love their banter. Their brother-sister banter is amazing.
It really is.
Claudia, who I related to so much. I feel like I was a little girl just like her. You know, she's a little bit extra. She's imaginative. If anyone's into Enneagram, she's totally a type 4, which I also am, but that's just
so funny
putting that out there. And then you have Jamie, on the other hand, who's this grounding force. He's very fiscally responsible, very organized, and he's very dry compared to her effusiveness. And they're just so much fun to read.
Yes, they really are just like peanut butter and jelly. It's fantastic. It's such a smart combination.
I don't know. I this book just came together so well for me. I wondered, you know, it is very much for children. I wondered, reading it for adults, would I feel the same magic if versus had I read this as a child and was coming back to it, you know, would I be missing that nostalgic element? And it's like, I wished I had just read this as a child. I loved it now. I'm sure I would have loved it even more had I read it back then.
Yes. I mean, but that's the nice thing. I think some of these things do hold up no matter what. And I think they're because the writing is so skillful and the frame is so interesting. I think you're always going to find something no matter when you pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to, I mentioned the year of it beforehand, because this book, you know, the way this book is set up and the mystery of it and the premise of them running away could not occur kind of the same way in our time period. Like, if you added cell phones to this story, it would lose all of its fun.
Those kids would be geotagged. They'd be like, find my friends. They'd be out of there in the first, you know, 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah. All these kids would have phones in their back pocket and they're like, they wouldn't need to do any
Googling the files.
Googling the files, and even the mystery itself and Mrs. Basil as a character, it would get just way more bureaucratic and things. It would not be nearly as fun. And so there is this suspension of disbelief and, you know, just falling into a story. And I'm like, that's what kids' books are all about. You know, we take everything else so seriously. Like, why take this seriously?
No, definitely. I think you're absolutely right.
And then, like, the other thing about this book, I don't even have too many criticisms, but I just love this. The other thing about this book that felt like perfect for me is just the art mystery angle to this. So
yes.
I've mentioned this on the show before, but one of my all-time favorite kids' books and one I grew up with is a book called Chasing Vermeer by...
Yes. I have read that. Yes.
Chasing Vermeer is one of my all-time favorite books, and it takes place at the University of Chicago and at the Art Institute in Chicago,
which
I live in the Chicago area now and features characters, you know, around this age range, and they're solving an art theft. And I just love the like intrigue of running around an art museum and just trying to find these things. It's so sophisticated, but then you have children kind of running in there. And
I mean, and a museum is like the most magical place in so many ways. Like there's something about it, just like there's a, it has like such this frozen, you know, it feels like you're on a movie set in a way. And it sort of lends itself to dramatic possibility. I think no matter what, you know, no matter what kind of, but specifically an art museum, I think that's really, yeah.
There's just this idea that there are all these stories, you know, all of this creativity in one place. And there's no limit to the amount of research and delving you can do, especially when these are done by, you know, long dead masters like Michelangelo. There's always things we're not going to know. And secrecy is such a big element of the story. And it just lends itself to just an endless number of stories you can tell.
Oh my gosh, definitely. I love that you brought that up too, that these like dead masters, these people who are, you know, who are revered for their work, like there are so many hidden facets that we'll never know. And I think that in and of itself is such an opening. Like it's such a, as a storyteller, there's so much potential for an opening there.
Right. And I just loved how we mentioned how timeless the story feels. Obviously, you adjust it for 60s things. Like imagine buying anything for 25 cents the way these people yes. saving their pennies and nickels. But it just adds to that homespun runaway from home energy. But you could imagine kids today just really enjoying this story. I don't know if you've ever shared this book with kids in your life, but I feel like this is a book that would easily lend itself to modern children even now.
Oh, definitely. I've definitely shared this with both of my kids, and they're both just as delighted as I was when I first read it. I think it was interesting for me to read it to them because they were born here in New York and they grew up here, and so they're coming at it from a very different perspective than I approached it. And it was interesting to see them, you know, they really respond to the characters so much more. Whereas I remember responding to the place so much more. So it was really interesting to sort of see that. But it is a testament to the strength of the characters that they are so faithful to, like, you know, even now, like even though they're written in the 60s, they're so faithful. Like there's such a degree of authenticity to them and their interaction, I think, as you mentioned earlier, as siblings, that really makes it impossible not to be moved.
Yeah, I love that you draw that distinction, because I'm imagining, you know, being a kid, you know, New York City's all you know, the setting might kind of fall into the background a little bit for you, because it's something you know these streets and you know the museum. You've probably been to this museum a bunch of times. And meanwhile, you can just kind of get into who these characters are and getting into kind of their trials and tribulations. So I feel like, you know, there's something to hold on to no matter what sort of vantage point you come from.
Definitely.
And I guess I'm just thinking a little bit about, I guess we can talk about Mrs. Basil herself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. She doesn't come in until, you know, obviously she narrates the story, but without spoiling anything, she doesn't really enter the story until towards the tail end. You know, I was listening the whole time and, you know, all I really had was this title and her as a narrator. And I'm like, when does she show up here? And it's very unconventional that, you know, the book is titled and framed this way, but you don't actually see her come in.
Yeah.
But, and I feel like it's, you know, I guess books written at that time, there's a couple other books I think of similarly to this, which I'll bring up, but it's very much kind of I feel like if this book was written now, you would have had her come in really, really early. It all would have been set up that way. But I liked, you know, not knowing when she was going to show up. And I thought, she is a character. I mean, who doesn't love the like older person who takes children seriously and
acts as
kind of benefactor in a way?
Totally. Totally. And I feel like the specter of her too, like via the narration, she's like this very formidable narrator. And you're sort of waiting. Like you said, you're like, when is she coming? Like what? Like it almost reminds me of that scene in The Devil Wears Prada, you know, when Meryl Streep like comes into the office. It's like, when is she coming? Like there's sort of like this anticipation of when, and it's a little bit scary because she is so intense. But I do feel like that's like that adds to the tension of this narrative too, which is really interesting and not something we see nowadays often.
For sure. And, you know, this kind of harkens back. I was saying it, I compare it to another older book that feels like this. And it's another one I read for the podcast about a year or so ago. And that was The Westing Game. Have you read The Westing Game?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've not read that.
So The Westing Game, it came out in the 70s, so a little bit after this. And basically, it's a mystery where children and adults are trying to gather clues. And it's this sort of challenge that's been set up by this billionaire. And it's like, whoever wins my challenge will win my fortune kind of thing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the kids are kind of looking to solve the mystery. And the billionaire is kind of this like teasing figure who has all the answers. And he's kind of in the background. And that kind of reminded me of that book, you know, has very different undertones. And I don't think that billionaire is quite as benevolent in the end as Mrs. Basil is. But the book has a very similar tone where it's like there are adults that stand in your way and then there are the adults that honor you and respect right. you, and you have to find right. the ones that kind of acknowledge you for who you are. It's a very kid-centered perspective, which I think was really common for books written back then.
I'm definitely going to have to look that up.
It's definitely a fun mystery for sure, and definitely meant for a similar age range as this book. And so definitely one I'd compare, and I always bring in comparisons towards the end of episodes, but this is definitely something I'd bring up, you know, if you've read The Westing Game or if read Basil E. Frankweiler, you know, the two I think would go hand in hand. And then I'll throw in a shout out for Chasing Vermeer, even though that was written much, much later, I think the mid-2000s when I was a kid. But Natalka, I'm curious to know if there are other books you'd throw into the ring as being similar in some way to From the Mixed Up Files.
Oh my gosh, I think you really nailed it with Chasing Vermeer. I think that one's really, really fantastic. I mean, I think any sort of, to me, it's funny because I almost picture movies more than books with this book, yeah. just because I'm thinking of like those classic, again, because of the time period, I'm thinking of like those like Marilyn Monroe, like those How to Marry a Millionaire, or like those yeah. movies that really feature like the landmarks, like the top of the Empire State Building. Like I really do feel like the city is so cinematic in this book that to me I'm almost like immediately thinking of just like old movies that are sort of lovingly, you know, displaying New York in its most in its best light.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I'm thinking about movies that combine like New York with like a kid character solving problems on their own, and I'm thinking of like Home Alone 2.
Yes, yeah, exactly, definitely.
Which is, I found out recently, you know, when I lived in New York, like the old creepy decrepit house that Kevin McAllister goes into in Home Alone 2 in like 1992 yes. is pretty much where I lived when I was in New York. It's so much funny. Like nicer gentrified area now. That's and it's so like, really, funny. Is this street? Like, but that was like all scary. Back
look at
then.
That. Look at you. You're part of history. That's amazing.
I lived like right on that street. And I'm like, are you kidding? 94? Wow.
You got to put that on your resume. I feel like that is something to be proud of.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So this book, I mean, I usually try to come in with something critical to say, but really I just had so much fun with this. It was just like a nice little story to get lost in, and just seeing their little hijinks, like all the little details here, right? The plan that Claudia is such a great planner, you know, she comes with this idea. She's like, all right, we're going to say we're going to music class, but instead we're going to stuff our violin cases yeah. and clothes. And
it's like, so glamorous. It's like such a glamorous plan from a grade school kid. It's really impressive.
Yeah. And glamorous is a great word, because that's really what Claudia is after in many yes. ways, is glamour. And that's such a, I don't know, I felt her just sort of deep in my soul, like that desire to be different and that yes. desire to just take a risk and like break yes. out of your everyday life, you know, tired of every week being the same. So I'm yes. going to do something totally different. And I love towards the end, the whole time I was wondering, you know, are they going to be concerned about their parents missing them? And that only really occurs to them towards the end. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, that makes sense. You're so, your kids, you're caught up in the
You're
adventure.
So self-absorbed too. Like yeah. you're so, you know, you're not thinking about anyone. You're literally mm-hmm. just like, yeah, right. You're living in the moment.
Yeah, that's the stage of life, you know, like I feel like kids don't learn to become, you know, fully actualized thinking about other people until totally. Much later on in development. And
oh
so,
my gosh, no question. And, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. That's a part right. of that time of life, because you are absorbing everything around you. And I'm sure there's some sort of like a biological imperative there. Like you have to know, you know, where the predators are or whatever, like on the savannah. But I think there really is there is something to that. You're right. Like that is one element that does seem to work because of the age that they are. Like they're not so little that they rely on and miss their parents, but they're not so old to really feel like, you know, guilt over worrying them. They're like in that sweet spot of just immersing themselves in the moment.
Exactly. And they're good kids. They're good kids at their core, and they want to do the right things, and they're just trying to have an adventure. And it's like, you know, we could all use a little bit of adventure in our lives. And this book really just kind of brings that to light. And so if you're like me and had missed out on this book as a kid, not too late to discover it for the first time as an adult. I think it's a lot of fun, whether you read this on paper or via an audiobook. The audiobook was only about 3.5 hours. It's actually really short for an audiobook. And
it's a great car trip.
Suggestion. You know, a car trip with some kids. I feel like you could easily just really have a good time.
100%.
For sure. And so, Natalka, before we close out today, can you tell us a little bit about where we can find you and where we can find your book?
Absolutely. I have a website, natalkaburian.com, with all of my information about my books, about the bars, about the nonprofit that I work with. And I'm on Twitter at natalkaburian. I am on Instagram at NDBURIAN. And I'm on TikTok at natalkaburian. And I pair cocktails with books. So I give cocktail recipes. Yeah, that was another thing I did during the pandemic when I was unemployed. I just started this TikTok account, and it's been really fun.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm gonna have to throw you on the spot here. I'm trying to. Can you give me an example of a book and cocktail pairing? I really want to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, did you read the Olga Tokarczuk "Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead"?
It's on my list.
It's so good. Okay, you got to read that. Put that at the top. I love this. Yes. I love that book. But the cocktail I paired with that was a corpse reviver, because there is. I mean, spoiler. I don't want to give it away. But there is a bit of a. There's a bit of a gruesome twist in there. So that was a fun one. But yeah, I've done many.
What goes into that?
Oh, it's an old, I mean, off the top of my head, I cannot tell you. I definitely had to look it up. It's not one I make often, but it's like gin. I believe there's like maraschino liqueur, lime. It's one of the older sort of, or maybe lemon, but it's definitely like from that, you know, the old school style of bartending where you just, it's very spirit forward, but somehow it still tastes really good. So I definitely recommend, and you can, it's on there. It's on my TikTok account. So you can definitely check it out. I make each one with the book in the background. So you're fully immersed. Talk about full immersion.
Oh my God. I am totally checking this out. I am often like, I can't find content for me on TikTok. And I'm like, that's my kind of content right there. So I will link your TikTok in the show notes.
Yes, please.
I think everybody needs some book cocktail combinations. I know I certainly do. That might be the first one I try out.
Yes.
But for everybody listening, you know, definitely check out Natalka's work. Actually, I'm curious. I meant to ask this before. Can you tell us about the nonprofit you work with?
Yes. Thank you so much for asking about that. So it's called the Freya Project. And I actually started it with a friend of mine who is also a writer, Noni Brisky. And we founded this reading series in the wake of the 2016 presidential election. And we would gather, you know, every month we would gather four or five different writers or artists or, you know, doctors, whoever wanted to share their story on a theme that was based around the work of an organization that we would support. So over the years, it all began sort of like every month we would support an organization that was kind of responding to the policies of the time. So like immigration, gun control, anything that we sort of thought was under attack, we would try to support in our modest way. But now we've sort of focused our efforts more on reproductive health. And that's been, as you know, like a front and center. And we're happy to say we've expanded. We've had Freya Project readings in Chicago. Our next one is in Chicago on July 27th. Yes, Julia Fine, the amazing author of The Upstairs House, is hosting.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, she's incredible. So it's a wonder, you know, our community has grown, and every year we give 5 unrestricted grants to our readers because we can't unfortunately pay them for their time. That's kind of our way of giving back to the readers. But over the years, we've raised a lot of money for a lot of really small, essential organizations. And for us, the criteria really is that the organizations be working in communities that are hostile to their work so that they know. Initially, it was about like building this bridge between, you know, coastal elites that was the buzzword at the time. And then all the people on the ground doing this work in places where maybe it was really hard to do that work. So it's been great. I mean, it's been a really rewarding experience. And also just at a time when so often you feel overwhelmed by things that seem unjust, it's been a harbor in those times. It's like, okay, I can't do everything, but I can do this.
I love that. There's so much about that messaging that I absolutely appreciate. And, you know, we on the show, we just came off of our fundraiser we held with one of our last episodes, you know, raising money for local abortion funds. Ugh, I mean,
yes. Thank you for doing that. Thank you so much for doing that.
No, thank you. I mean, it's just, it's hard to feel powerless in times where there's all these systemic issues going on, but often decided on people that we did not have a say in one way or another, and just feeling like that autonomy is being taken away from you in so many ways. And so I'm definitely grateful for your foundation. And you said Chicago and Julia Fine, and I'm immediately going to go look this up.
Please, please go. I bet you'd love to see you. And we have some great readers this month. I mean, we had our first Chicago event. It was so funny. We were supposed to have our first one in March of 2020. But as you can imagine, that one got canceled. Yeah. So we finally had our first rescheduled one in the spring in Chicago, and it was so great. And I'm just so delighted to be, you know, to be growing, because, you know, that's part of it was never meant to just be in New York. It was always, the goal was always to have these events anywhere anyone wanted to have one, to expand the community. And so, and I think there is something so healing about being in a room with other people who, you know, who feel the same way you feel, and just listening. It's just such a powerful experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you all for sharing that with us. And I mean, I think I can speak for my listeners that a lot of us are going to check that out now. And Natalka, thank you for your book and for your time. And I wish you all the best as this book hits the shelves.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. This was such a wonderful conversation. I had so much fun.
And thank you all for listening. As a reminder, we have one more episode next week. That'll be the end of our season. Then I'll be taking a couple weeks off. And then starting out in August, second week of August, we'll have episodes every other week. And so going back to a more manageable schedule for us, for sure. And so if you like the show, please let me know about it. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcast, always open to constructive criticism and, of course, compliments. You can also leave reviews on most of the major podcast platforms like Apple, Google, Spotify, what have you. And make sure to check out some of the books we've talked about today, because really, I don't recommend anything that I didn't myself enjoy. So take that all into consideration, and happy reading.